Good morning, everyone. I think we're just about ready to get started, so if we could settle down a little bit. I know that some of you are still finding your places. This is a crowded room, and thank you so much for filtering in as you come in. We're really very excited to welcome all of you this morning to the Women in Technology Lunch, which is something that we've been doing for several years here at TechEd. And what's exciting for me and for my colleagues is that every year that we do this lunch, it gets bigger. And every year we get a more enthusiastic audience, so you have a lot to live up to. Where I want to start is, you've seen that our theme is breakthrough, overcoming obstacles to success. And in this year of Sheryl Sandberg and Lean In, we've heard a lot about the internal obstacles to success, the things that we hold ourselves back. But I think that external obstacles are still real. I think that external obstacles are still important. My name is Lindsay Berg. I'm a senior product marketing manager with the Cloud and Enterprise Division at Microsoft. I write the story that crosses Windows Server, Microsoft System Center, and Microsoft Azure. And if you had told me even 10 years ago that this would be my passion and that I would be incredibly enthusiastic about trying to figure out the best way to explain the significance of infrastructure to a world that largely wants the infrastructure to work and be ignored, I would have been very surprised. And I think in my own career, what I have seen primarily as the obstacle is not knowing what's possible. And that's one thing we're going to talk about today. My own mother has a PhD in astrophysics. She is currently the Vice President for Student Affairs at Caltech and a member of President Obama's National Science Board. And what she said to me on this topic was, at least then, at least when I started, you could see what the obstacles were. When she started graduate school in the 1970s, people said to her that it wasn't really appropriate for her to take a job and earn a salary when she had a perfectly good husband who was willing to support her. And of course, if she needed the money, that would have been different. But the idea of her going outside of the home to get a deeper education and to leave us, my sister and me, with people who were not our parents, it was in some ways a radical concept at the time. And people were upfront about that. They were upfront about the fact that they didn't think necessarily that she had the right to be there. And she said that in some ways that was easier. In some ways it was awful. In some ways you would go home at the end of the day and cry. But in some ways at least you knew what you were up against. And so that's the other thing that we want to talk about today. We want to talk about identifying obstacles and finding the places where someone else is holding you back that you haven't necessarily noticed. And it may not necessarily be because you're female. Because I don't think that we want to overestimate the obstacles that we face as women versus the obstacles that we face as people trying to build careers in what is still a difficult economy. Technology offers us many, many opportunities. And I'm super excited about the chances that we have to take advantage of those opportunities. But I think that we have to be conscious about the things that get in our way. I'd now like to introduce our panelists. With us today, we have Kim Johnson, who's a group program manager with Xbox Entertainment and Services. We have Vanessa Keenan, who is Assistant Vice Provost for IT at the University of Texas, San Antonio. And we also have Lori Lampkin, who's Director of Program Management in our Visual Studio Cloud Services business. All of these women have accomplished an enormous amount in their careers, and I'm really excited to have them talk to you about where they've been and where they're going. So I'm going to turn it over to them. We're going to start with Kim and let her talk a little bit about her background. Our other women panelists are going to do the same thing, and then we have some questions to kind of get the discussion flowing. So I'll start with you, Kim.
Hey, everyone. So as Lindsay said, my name is Kim Johnson. I am a group program manager for Xbox Entertainment Services team. My team is responsible for building all of the back-end services to support the service-driven entertainment experiences within Xbox. So that's for Xbox One, Xbox 360, and the other branded Xbox experiences we deliver across devices and will continue to deliver. So a little bit of background, a little bit of background about me. So I actually got into this career in a little bit different way than is, I think, typical. Interestingly, my mother actually celebrated her 40th year as a developer last year before she retired. And so growing up, I was around technology almost constantly. I decided that that was not what I wanted to do because it was the most boring thing in the world, typical child who is going against their parents and goes a very different direction. So when I went to school, I ended up actually majoring in pre-veterinary medicine and then also psychology. And I went through college, taking psychology classes, taking biology classes, working for a veterinarian most of my college career. late on in my college career, when I was a junior, end of my junior year, I actually saw a flyer on campus that said technical support representatives for TurboTax needed in the evenings after school. And so I signed up and went in and interviewed, and I actually got a position supporting TurboTax, doing technical support on the phones for TurboTax in the evenings during tax season. It was interesting work. It was definitely an experience in customer service and in technical support, and I learned a lot those couple years. Inevitably, I was the person who got the call when someone was a couple martinis into their tax return and decided that our software had to be really buggy. There was no way that they could owe the federal government money. And so these are the kinds of things that I learned early on. I ended up staying on with Intuit after I graduated, and the rest is kind of history from there. So my background, how I got here, it's a little bit interesting, but happy to be here where I am today. Love Microsoft. I am super excited about working on Xbox. Really happy to be here today and have an opportunity to talk with you all.
Great. My name's Lori Lampkin. I'm also very excited to be here. I am the Director of Program Management for Visual Studio Cloud Services. So what that is if you've heard of Visual Studio Online or Team Foundation Server, it's a set of developer tools that helps people collaborate while they're building software. So version control, bug tracking, that sort of thing, but also team collaboration tools. I find that that's the most awesome job and product for me to work on because I have a passion for technology, and I have a passion for shipping software, and I have a passion for people working together. So not only do I get to do that in my job, but I get to build tools for people to help them do it in their jobs. So that's been really special for me. A little bit about myself. Early on, I found I had a passion for computer science. I liked the fact that I could write some code and see some results. It was like solving a problem and this immediate reward. And so I went to the University of Washington, and I went through the math and computer science program there, and when I graduated, I said, I want to go work for Microsoft, that small little company local to the area, and that was in 1990, and I've been working there ever since, and it's been a great place for me because it's a fast-paced environment with a lot of smart people that make me feel dumb every day, so I know I'm learning, and I've pretty much been working on developer tools since I started. I started out in developer support, similar, working on the phones, helping people, usually not after a couple of martinis, but of course nothing was wrong with their code. It was definitely our tool, so similar that way. And I quickly became a manager. I think I was 1 year into the job and I became the team manager, and then a couple years later the unit manager, because I liked talking to customers and I liked the technology, but I kind of liked solving the problems for the group that the group was having and getting things done. And that was fun, but I was missing something. I was getting more into the business aspect and learning a lot there of running a technical support business. But I was getting far away from the actual product and the technology. So at that point in time, I went to work in the Visual Studio team. Back then it was Visual C++, the first version of that, and in program management, where I could talk to customers and I could design solutions for their problems, and I could see those solutions get built and deliver them to customers and repeat that process. And so I've been in the program management discipline in various areas of Visual Studio, and it's been wonderful. And thank you for having me here. I'm very happy to be here. Vanessa?
I'm Vanessa Keenan, and I can't tell you how excited I am to be here. And not only excited, I was at this event last year in New Orleans to see what a big crowd. It's almost triple the number of people here. And what that tells me is a lot of people maybe followed up on some of the things we talked about at Women in Technology last year. So just to give you a little bit of background and information about me, I'm the Assistant Vice Provost for Information Technology for the University of Texas in San Antonio. And I work with everything from what you call the human resource management in IT. We have just under 200 employees, as well as the marketing and communications of all the products that we launch out. A lot of those products are Microsoft products. So we work on marketing so that way when those products are launched, that we're just not sending those products out, but that people across our campus are actually using them. We have over 5,000 employees at the University of Texas in San Antonio and just under 30,000 students. So we have a very large client base right there, over three different campuses. And so my journey to IT was really, really interesting because I started off as a non-traditional student. So how did I get on this journey? First of all, I was a first-generation college student, which means that basically neither one of my parents had gone to college. So I finished school in the top 8% of my class, but did not go directly to college because I didn't have sort of those resources to send me in that direction. So I didn't go back to school until after I was married and had two children. So my husband was very kind of old-fashioned Southern guy and was not real, real big on me going back to college, but I made that decision that this was something I really wanted to do. So I go back and I get into a non-traditional, you know, I'm a non-traditional student, but I'm also in a highly selective university. So his financial advisors told him, hey, let her go back to school. If she does this, if she can get into this particular university, let me tell you something, she'll be taking care of you when the time comes and you get older. So let her go. Let her go and pay for it. So I did with two kids, and it was not easy. I was in school at 8 in the morning, getting off at 3, running to pick up the kids. And then I found in my senior year, I was pregnant with my third child. So I had to make a big decision. Am I going to stick with this or move on and do something else? I stuck with it because he didn't think I was going to finish. So that was my push to keep going because he said, this is just something you want to do. You won't finish. So not only did I finish my undergraduate degree, but I went on and finished my master's and my doctorate as well. The important thing on the technology end is I got started in technology way back when I was in high school, and IBM had MagCart systems. So that gives you a little bit about my age, right? So went on. When I was in college, I took this class in computer science because people told me this is a good, easy class to kind of fill your science requirements. Well, I found that to not be the case. It was a tough class. But that course helped me because I moved on and worked in database management. I worked in database management in nonprofits and then went on to work in private education. Well, the interesting thing is I worked in database management, teaching database classes at a time when Y2K was coming in. And if you know anything about databases and Y2K during that time, it was very serious. So that really helped me in my career. When a position came open, when I was working on my doctorate degree for a fellowship at the University of Texas, I took advantage of it, and that particular position took me all over the world. I got a chance to go out and talk about global technology and present in Lisbon, Portugal, Shanghai, Beijing, lots of opportunities there, and stayed on with the University of Texas. When a position came open, because once I finished my fellowship, I could not stay in that particular department, a position came open, and I took it and moved into information technology. And I cannot tell you, I think my boss is somewhere here in the room, but going in and actually having a chance to interview with him and to hear the fantastic things they were planning on doing, I knew this was the place I wanted to be. And so from there, we're working on Gates grants with the integrated planning and advising system. It has been nonstop and exciting for me. So that's a little bit about my journey, just a little bit, a pinch of my journey in information technology.
Thanks so much, everybody. Where I really want to start is, you know, for you to tell me what was the biggest obstacle that you faced in these journeys that you've taken. And I'd like to start with Lori, actually.
I like going first. Biggest obstacle I've had a couple that I can think of that were a real struggle for me. The first one is at one point in my career, I always say that when you're early in your career, you get feedback from people, and it's kind of easy to, you know, oh, okay, I know how to take that and do something with it. But all the easy stuff gets taken care of early in your career, and then it gets to be later, and the feedback that you get is much harder to work on. And I had kind of stalled in my career. I hadn't gotten a promotion in 7 or 8 years, which seemed like forever, and I was just thinking I'm never going anywhere. And I started getting very frustrated with myself. And what happened was I was needing to learn a new set of skills that were about being more of a strategic partner versus being more of a tactical manager of my team. And I don't want to say that, I didn't think about strategy. I mean, that's of course I did. But the thing was is that I tended to think of my team as the people that I worked closely with and that worked for me, and not the larger team, you know. And that meant partnering with me was more challenging for other people. They liked me. They could count on me. I would get stuff done that I committed to, but I wasn't more of open and I don't know. I can't really explain what it was, and neither could my manager. They couldn't really explain to me why it wasn't clicking. And so when I was faced with that, I was really like, I don't know what to do. I don't know what to do. And I realized, and it took quite a bit of self-discovery, that I needed to think about that larger team and just take a little bit of a step back, you know, and just let go a little bit, which was really hard because for me, the way I'd succeeded up to that point was to work harder and work more, you know, and this was more about being more patient and being more giving and open with my partners as peers versus, you know, my team versus your team or something like that. So it took quite a bit for me to change my thinking, you know, to think differently. And I see a lot of people and mentor a lot of people at that same phase in their career. I haven't seen anybody not hit that phase, you know, where they what was working for them before stops working for them and they don't know what to do. And I think the big learning for me was being frustrated about it made me stall my career. You know, if I had embraced it and kind of leaned in, became more discover what's really going on here, if I was more patient with myself, then maybe I would have learned that earlier. It took me a long time to figure it out, but now that I have, that I feel like that's my gift that I can give other people, is to try to help coach them through that discovery process to figure out how do I change to really move into a new level of impact.
And I think that Lori raises an important point. I was once talking actually to my boss's wife, and she said, I could never do what you do. And I said, well, that's odd. Of course you could. I mean, you might not like infrastructure. Again, it's not everyone's bliss. But I think that she has tremendous skills. She's a great writer. And she said, the thing about Microsoft is you people seem to take a lot of feedback all the time about virtually everything. And she said, and I couldn't do that. And I think that that's true. I do think that Microsoft in particular, and I don't know if all of you are aware of this, but it's a feedback intensive place. It's a making yourself better kind of place. And that can be extremely difficult. And I've watched a lot of people go through that journey of, it's even worse when you're getting the feedback that whatever you're doing isn't working, but no one can tell you how to fix it. And so I think that that's one of the things that we sort of have to watch for, is when you hit those stalling places, is it an inner journey? Is it a question you have to ask yourself? Or is it a question that you can ask somebody else? And this whole idea of feedback and looking outward for advice, it only gets you so far. There's a moment when you have to look inward. So I think that's a really great point. Kim, do you want to talk a little bit about your experience?
Sure, absolutely. So one of the things that has been challenging for me, I gave you a little bit of my background early on. I don't have a technical degree, and my background in educationally was not in tech. I've never been a developer. I've never been a tester. But yet I was on a career path that took me into an engineering team. And one of the challenges for me early on was not only other people's perception of the fact that I didn't have that technical background and my ability to be successful in those roles, but my own perception that I didn't have a technical background and that I wasn't going to be able to be successful with certain assignments. And so what would end up happening early on in my career is I would sort of run away from the more technical assignments, and I would take the ones that were less technical, more collaborative, more coordination, that type of thing. And so early on, that hurt me in terms of my ability to expand, to be promoted in those roles. And I sat down with a mentor who was also my skip-level boss at the time, and one day for a lunch and sync-up mentoring kind of opportunity. And she said to me, you know what? I have seen you on so many occasions explain a concept to an architect, and I'm pretty sure you understood it better than they did. I think you're selling yourself way short on thinking that you don't have the technical capabilities simply because you don't have that background. She said, really, you need to step back and think about it and go after some of these more technical opportunities in projects. Take on some technical assignments. Stretch yourself. go to a place where you feel uncomfortable, because that's where you're actually going to learn. And so I started to do that, and this was probably, I don't know, 7 or 8 years ago now. And I was so amazed by the progress I made, and it was all about my own confidence. And it was all about the fact that I needed to step out and be really uncomfortable to get to that next point. And so what I would say is, don't ever sell yourself short. Just because you may not have an experience or a degree in some specific area doesn't mean you're not capable. And so really look for that feedback from your peers, from managers, mentors, et cetera, because that's really where that next step of growth is going to happen for you.
Yeah, and I think that the theme of discomfort is likely to persist, because that is how we grow. There's no question in my mind that the number one thing holding you back is that the first step is not going to be fun, the first step into a new area. Vanessa, what would you?
You know, the environments are very different, and I look at the environment I work in today is so much different than the environment when I first started in technology. And one of the first obstacles I ran into was being a female, and one of the positions I'd applied for was as a career services director. So this meant that I was going to be working with government agencies, placing people in IT positions, engineering, with the military, the whole works. And most of the people I would be working with were males. So I'll never forget when I applied for that position, I said, you know, I could do this. The person who was hiring me said to me, just straight offhand, you know, you're a woman. Do you think you can really handle, these guys are tough. Do you think you can really handle them? And I remember saying, yes, I really feel I can do this and I can do a good job. I'll get the rates up, things. To this date, I serve on an advisory committee for that private school, and I have some of the best rates still coming in. When they have questions, they come back to me, and there have been many, many women to follow me and take on that position. So I thought that was just very odd, whereas where I am now, that question would never be asked. So it really kind of depends. The environments are very different. The other question, and I thought this was so funny. The first time we were asked to go over into China, I was asked to go to Beijing and to mainland China for about 2.5 weeks. And the president said to my boss, you're going to send Vanessa to China for 2.5 weeks? We're going to send a woman to China for 2.5 weeks by herself? No, you need to go and get a visa some kind of way within the next week and go to China with Vanessa. And he did. My boss had never left the country, so he had to figure out a way to get to Houston, get over here, get the visa, get everything done quickly, and went with me. Well, the funny thing is, when we came back, his response was, you know what? I could have just sent Vanessa alone, because all they wanted to talk to in my Chinese name over there was Wanisa. I guess there's no V's, so they all call me Wanisa. He said, all I ever heard over there was Wanisa, and they wanted her to stay for a year, and we told them absolutely not. She's coming back here to work for us. So those were the kind of things. I would not see that in the environment I am in now at the University of Texas, but probably some of you may face some of those same challenges even today.
Yeah, and you're talking about an external obstacle, which I think is super important. How did you handle it when that message was given to you? I mean, I think that it's really important how we respond in those moments. So at that moment in time, what were you feeling, and how did you respond to the questions that were being asked?
Well, in both cases, because it was about me being a female, and in both cases, I wasn't taken aback, and I was professional about how I handled it. And immediately I said, yes, that's not going to be a problem for me. And what I did, especially the first time around when I was asked, how would you handle these tough guys? I just told my boss straight offhand, do you realize how many of these guys are single dads? They come in and talk to me all the time. Some of them have daughters, and they don't know how to handle those issues. If they can come in and talk to me about their personal lives, this part is going to be fairly easy. So I used examples of how I had already handled some of the problems with these people. So that worked out very, very well for me.
Yeah, and I think that you changed the paradigm. Yeah. You basically said, you're thinking of them as men who have certain characteristics, and you're thinking of me as a woman who has certain characteristics, but actually we have a shared characteristic called parenting.
Yes.
And I think that that's the important thing, is to look for those points of continuity and shared experience, and that does often help get past those difficult moments. The next thing I wanted to talk about was, what are some common mistakes that you have seen, that you've made yourself if you feel comfortable, or mistakes that you've seen other women around you make that you find really frustrating? And I'm gonna have Kim go first this time.
All right, so I can talk about lots of mistakes I've made myself over the years. So I think one of the things that mistakes I made early on, in fact, actually I've made in the last few years even, and I continue to have to train myself, is work-life balance. I have two kids. I have a 9-year-old and a 5-year-old, and I'm married. I am very lucky in that my husband became a stay-at-home dad. He left Microsoft after our second child was born, which was awesome for our family. Interestingly, it actually enabled me to have a worse work-life balance than I did before that. And so I've had to retrain myself again now in the last few years to get back to a better work-life balance. It's funny, I say work-life balance because it's a term everyone knows. I kind of think of it more as work-life integration. And that's one of the things that working in the high-tech field, working in a field where you can kind of always be connected, is a very bad thing and yet a good thing at the same time in some cases, because you are able to leave the office, go home, go to your kid's baseball game, go to your daughter's gymnastics meet, and then get back online and do something else later that you needed to do to catch up. And so one of the things I would say is that try to find, it's easy to do that integration and it's useful in some cases, try to find some separation also, because otherwise you are always connected. Your phone, in fact, my phone is like 15 feet away from me right now. That is a record probably for this week. So really try to find those places that you can separate and focus on what is most important. My family is the most important thing in my life by far. I also love my career, and it's something that I want to continue to pursue my entire life. But in order to do that, I have to have balance. And so one of the big things for me is really continuing to reaffirm finding that balance and evolving as, you know, I advance in my career, et cetera. What does that balance look like for me year over year? And how does the changes to my family impact that as well?
And I think that's really true. I think that also if we watch, it's easier to see in other people, but if you overinvest in your career versus what I would think of as your life, the problem is that ultimately your career suffers. Eventually you will burn out. It's a really great short-term strategy, but I think we've all learned the hard way that it's a really bad long-term strategy because you can only do it for so long.
Absolutely.
And there is sort of that lure of the temporary achievement. If I put in so many hours over 6 months, then there's a lot of good that can be gained from that, but not in the long term. What do you think, Lori?
About
mistakes.
Oh, yes. How could I forget? Mistakes. I think the big mistake that I've seen myself make and I've seen a lot of women make is to just be very clear about what you want and to ask. You know, and ask doesn't mean demand. You know, like ask means ask and be open to the outcome, you know. But, for example, at one point in my career, this is I was a group program manager, and there was, at that point in time, the next position available was a multidiscipline manager, so running group program management, development, and test. And we were struggling with our organization. We had a team in North Carolina and a team in Redmond, and they were all under one multidiscipline manager, and it was just hard. The team was growing. It was getting bigger, and we needed to do something about it. So we knew a big reorganization was coming. And I was the group program manager of the team that was in Redmond and Washington. And I wanted them to split the team in two and create a site manager in North Carolina and one in Redmond. And I thought that will fix all the problems. And I would like to have that job of the multidiscipline manager in Redmond. And I kind of was sitting there waiting for someone to clue in that this was the right solution. Like, it's obvious, right? This is the right solution. And they were brainstorming a bunch of other things, and I happened to be privy to some of the ideas. And finally, I just said, well, what if you just broke the team into these two different segments? And they're like, it actually hadn't occurred to them. And here I was thinking, well, maybe they just don't want to put me in that position, or they don't want to make me feel bad. Or, you know, I was putting all this on myself, and as soon as I put it out there, they were like, well, let's think about that idea. They took it seriously. They ended up doing it. And then I said, well, I'm going to learn from this. And I'm going to say, and I would like to take that job here in Redmond. And they're like, well, you would be great at that job. And I was like, oh my gosh, I just asked and it happened. You know, it was a revelation to me. So that I've taken with me. And I was just talking to a gal in Microsoft that I mentor the other day, and she's pregnant right now, and she's not feeling well. And she's like, I just feel like I need to come in a couple of hours later. You know, I need to work from home in the mornings. And I said, oh, I'm going to tell her. Just ask. And you know what? She did. And she's like, 3 months later, everything is so much better, you know, that she's still sick, unfortunately. But she just feels like, I can manage this now. And I didn't realize that I could just ask and that flexibility would be there for me. So that's my takeaway, is just get an idea. If you're clear on what you want and you ask and you're open to no is okay, then it might just be yes. So
yeah, and that's so true, though, the openness to no.
Yeah,
but because no isn't a catastrophe. I think that's what we worry about, that the answer will be no and that somehow this will be a catastrophe. But it actually doesn't put you any farther back than you were before you asked.
That's right.
Vanessa, what do you think about mistakes?
I'm going to start off with listening. I'll never forget, this was a big mistake for me as a manager and as a worker. And one day I was in a meeting with one of my bosses, and he just very loudly said, you just do not listen. And it made me really stop. And there's sometimes, even today, when I'm working and I'm passionate about something, that I have to stop and listen. Even when I say listen, that listening can be silence. Silence can tell you a lot about what's going on in your surroundings and what's happening with you. So that's real important. And actually, another mistake is I think we don't call on our mentors enough. We don't call on our mentors enough and utilize the background and the information those mentors can give to you. And I think sometimes as females, we don't count on male mentors. I look back and I keep a list on my desk of the 7 people that have made the most impact in my life. And from time to time, I may call upon those people for help. But out of those 7 people, only 2 of them are women. The other 5 are males that have been very, very instrumental in my life. And one of them, since I was 15 years old. And that person and I still stay in touch. I'm 55 now. So we've stayed in touch all of these years, and he still has an impact on my life.
That's actually an interesting question. Do you have thoughts on mentoring and how you find great mentors? I know it's a topic that's usually pretty interesting to people. You want to?
Go ahead.
To your point, or a minute ago, I ask. When I find somebody that I feel has some characteristics that are actually very different than me, where they have strengths that I do not have at all, those are the people I seek out for mentorship. It's interesting, being a woman, one of the things, a woman in a leadership role at Microsoft or any other tech company, people have a tendency to try to want to hook us up with other women because they think those are the best mentors for us. I have great women mentors, and I think there is a super important piece of that. But the diversity is also really, really important. So that's one of the other things, is I always try to make sure that I have a diverse set of mentors across disciplines, across the company, you know, different roles, people that are, you know, peers of mine, people that are leaders above me. But I think the diversity is just critical.
Absolutely. Yeah. Lori, did you?
Yeah, I think it's really hard because I think that's a great piece of advice because it's really hard. I've had many matchmaking opportunities of people pairing people up to mentor, and there's sometimes just this click where you know it works or it doesn't work, you know. And I think that I need to be in a place where I feel safe, you know, that I can actually open up to someone. I was mentored with a senior vice president at Microsoft once, and that was really hard because he wasn't in my business unit, and it was hard because I'm like, what do I talk to him about, you know? And I talk to him about his family and my family, and you know, where are we going to connect here? And so I think, to me, I just realized that for me to get real value out of something, I've got to be in a position where I can say, I suck. These are my problems. You know, I'm lost. You know, and have somebody not go, okay, I'm going to write that down next time. You know, so that was it for me.
Yeah, and the vulnerability is always the trick, because you can't get good advice if you don't admit what's wrong. And so you have to have an environment in which you're comfortable actually saying, I have screwed this thing up so badly, and I don't see the path forward.
Let's talk a little bit about technology specifically. We're in a time of tremendous change. I think that that was clear from the keynote. I know that that's been clear from the customer feedback that I've been getting this week. You know, we know that we're moving to cloud. How fast is that going to happen? Wish I could tell you. What I wonder is, do you feel like that creates opportunity? Because that's what I'm seeing is that it's creating opportunity for women. But I'm curious as to whether you've seen that in your own experience. Maybe Vanessa, would you like to talk about that a little?
Sure, I'd love to. I think as females, we tend to be social butterflies. We just do. And what's happening now with technology? It's the social media, right? There's so much going on with social media. We've heard the Yammer. We've heard a lot about Yammer during this conference. And I think that's a great opportunity because we tend to be a little bit maybe more social, it gives us some good opportunity to give some input on what's going to be happening and going forward with technology, because we just tend to have, it's just a natural instinct for us as women. So I think the fact that there is so much going on with social media will give us a lot of new inlets and outlets to be able to have some input as to what goes on with the growth of technology.
I would build on that. I agree, because I think it's not even just social, but technology used to kind of be something for work and something in the back that, you know, a lot of people didn't even know was happening as they got their work done, maybe using Office or something like that. But now it seems like all of that technology is everywhere. It permeates your whole life. It's, you know, the Netflix that you use to watch TV. It's the games that your kids are playing, or, you know, it's just everywhere. And to me, that just means more people are going to be interested in technology because they're exposed to it just as a consumer in their daily life.
So the other thing that I would add, and this is, I think, away from the women aspect of it a little bit, but I think that technology and the move to cloud, one of the things for us in Xbox when we went from 360 to Xbox One is Xbox One is a completely service-driven experience. We have telemetry data about usage that is just phenomenal. This has enabled us to really make some good decisions, data-driven decisions, in a way that we haven't been able to in the past. And so I'm seeing that, and coming from, I actually moved from within Microsoft from the server and cloud division to Xbox a couple years ago. And I'm really seeing us being able to grab onto that and move forward with it very quickly in terms of having the data to make these types of decisions has really enabled us to give our customers better experiences and to iterate on those experiences and deliver more and more in terms of enhancements very, very quickly. And it's really changed things for us. With Xbox One, we've seen, you know, we've done monthly updates, something we've never been able to do in the past. And the feedback that we've gotten from our customers around that has been phenomenal. And so the cloud aspect of it for me is really about those data-driven decisions that we as engineering teams and designers can make far more effectively than we could 5 or 10 years ago when we had much less real-time data. So,
yeah, and I think what it comes down to is that change is opportunity. Change is a moment when, if you have an idea that somebody else hasn't had yet about how to handle it, that's the time that you can step forward and really make your mark on a situation. Whereas in a static situation where it's much more established personalities, I think it's harder to insert yourself. I think that this is, you know, and that's what I think the advantage of the time of change really is. I think what we'd like to do now is actually open the questions up to the floor a little bit. So we do have microphones out there, and people are happy to bring you one. Do we have a question at all from our room? If you'd like to, I can see the mic is right close to you, so that's handy.
I'd like to ask how you deal with, I guess, the perception of being bossy when you have an opinion as a woman.
I am
You've
bossy.
Never been, yeah, I was gonna say. Bossy and proud of it.
I know, I am bossy.
Yeah.
Assertive.
It's all about the word you use to describe that characteristic.
Do I have any advice with the perception of being bossy? I honestly embrace that. You know, I mean, I do say, you know, I take more of a positive spin on that, and I just make sure, like I said earlier, that I continue to try to partner with people and not be all, you know, my team, your team. I think that helps because, you know, I'm not always putting on the bossy air, but I do think that, yeah, that's just, we're trying to get stuff done here, right?
So. I will say from my own experience that taking the time to build a little consensus before you go into a big room and announce what it is that you were planning to do anyway. There's the back work of, I have spent time in your office, I explained this to you personally, you may not have agreed with me, but you feel like I heard you. And as I say, then I go into the big room, and I would go with bossy. I feel pretty comfortable with that. You cannot move projects forward without being assertive. But there are ways and ways of making people feel as though you brought them along on the journey. I don't know if you've had any experience with this, because you're on a fairly large team, don't you, Kim?
Yeah. So the biggest thing is, for me, is transparency of my thought process to those around me so that they're taken on the journey with me in terms of how we get from A to B. The term bossy is interesting because I think we've had this conversation before, maybe. The term bossy is typically used to describe girls and women far more often in the same circumstance than men. It's actually a very gender-specific word. So it's a good question. I think the biggest thing, though, for me has just been transparency of thought, openness, straightforwardness with my team and with my peers, so that they've kind of come on that journey with me. So we've gotten to the point of, hey, here's the decision, here's the direction we're going, here's the decision that I'm making at this point. We got there together. Not everyone may agree, not everyone always agrees. I mean, it's just the way it is, but having that transparency with people, for me, has historically made a huge difference in overcoming that perception.
Yeah. So do you want to add anything, Vanessa?
Sure. I'm so glad you brought that up, because it's so frustrating sometimes, and I think we all go through this, when you can see something that you'll say in a certain way, and it'll be seen as bossy or aggressive or overly assertive, and a gentleman can say it a lot tougher, a lot louder, but that perception is there. And so it's a tough one. It's a tough one to overcome. But I do believe, and I think it was the comment came over here, the fact that if you're taking folks along on a journey and kind of have them to feel that they're empowered as a part of what's going on, if you're working on projects, and I work on a lot of projects with teams. So if you can bring them along and make sure that they feel empowered, they can see what's in it for them as well as a part of that journey, sometimes that'll kind of, how shall I say, mellow the tide with people thinking that maybe you're a little bit too bossy about how you're going about the perception that's there about you. But it's a tough one for females. It just is.
It is. But don't ever let them stop you from asserting yourself as a result.
Yes.
That is the wrong response.
Very true.
Does someone else have a question? Yes.
Thank you. My name is Selina Ekingdan-Albert. I'm from Nigeria. And I'd like to know what strategies and modalities the Microsoft organization is proposing to improve capacity building in Africa, with special respect to the cloud technology and the role the women can play in African countries to enforce cloud technology. Thank you.
I will take the capacity question because that's in my area of specialization. So when we look at building data centers, one of the big things that we have to look at is connectivity. So the biggest challenge that we're facing in Africa, from what I understand, is cross-continent connectivity. The pipes are a lot stronger if you're going north-south than if you're going east-west. So right now, the data centers that we're operating for the region, we are primarily in South Africa, and I don't know how big that one is. And then our main data center that we are recommending is in Brussels. And it truly is mostly a question of the connectivity and the networking. The broader question you're asking about opportunity for women, I think, is a slightly different one. What we would like to see is a world in which cloud computing means that compute is readily available, that it's cheap, and that there's more opportunity to think beyond what you might have done. That is actually, I think, the miracle of cloud, is this idea of, if capacity and if scale are no longer the limiting factors, and if cost can be driven down so dramatically, then what can we do? So for me, and again, I know this sounds slightly crazy, but we have to work on the network in Africa. We have to take all the regions of the world that are not currently well served by broadband, and we have to invest in the infrastructure to make more things possible in those regions. There are stories already of the good that's being done with cellular technology in Africa, and about the difference that, for example, if you have one doctor serving a variety of villages, and you equip that doctor with a cell phone, and then you put a cell phone in each of the villages, well, now all of a sudden your doctor isn't spending half of their time driving to a village arbitrarily to find out if there's a problem there. So for me, and again, this comes from, to a certain extent, from my own bias and my own background, but it's about infrastructure, and it starts with the cellular technology, but it also hits the broadband and it hits the network, because the good that we can offer through the cloud is not accessible until you can rely on the network. So I would say that that's really the point of investment. Another question? Yes.
Hi, my name is Ming Fei, and I work in Microsoft too as a program manager in Azure. So my question is something related to female, that sometime during the discussion that I felt I'm being misaccused to be too emotional during the discussion, just because I'm a female PM. And I felt it, the words brought up quite often compared to a male colleague who I think expressed the same strong position on certain discussion. So how do you see this being emotional thing that, I mean, is that a bad thing for female working in the workplace, or that could somehow translate into certain advantage?
Lawyer Kim, since this is PM, would either of you like to start there?
I think that's a really hard question. I think that, as opposed to the bossy word, which is I don't take so much offense to, because it's the too bossy part that you have to watch out for, the emotional word is much harder for me. Like, that is, that seems like inappropriate for the workplace, is the connotation around that word. And there's got to be, you know, room for a passion. You know, passion's the more positive version of that same sort of expression. And I don't know why that sometimes gets assigned more to women. I see that as well. I try to just, you know, make sure that I am present in a meeting and clear and firm, but not, but still open and listening, and then just make sure that I really try to just tone it down and make sure that I maybe overcompensate or maybe suppress some of that passion, just because I have had similar feedback myself when I thought I wasn't being all that emotional, and someone's like, wow, you're kind of being emotional, and it's like, oh, okay. So I think I just learned over time to just use different ways to express that passion. And try different things to make sure I could still be my true, genuine self, but it wasn't coming across differently. So,
thank you.
So, for me, this one is always an interesting one to me. In my time leading teams, I have not found this to be a more female characteristic. I have, you know, emotion, passion, however you want to put it. So it bothers me when this gets assigned to women more than men, because that's just not been my actual experience. Personally, for me, I think one of the things that I've gotten credit for in my career has been passion around things. And so one of the ways that, and also sometimes in a negative way, like, it's okay, just chill out, it's all going to be fine. This might crash and burn, but it'll be fine. We'll move on, and something, you know, something else will happen here. But so I've had to sort of balance the negative emotion and the positive emotion for myself personally, and really trying to focus on positive passion rather than negative passion or negative emotion given certain work experiences. But again, I have not found it to ring true that this is a more female problem than it is for anyone in the workplace. Overly emotional about things, especially in a leadership position, you have a tendency to scare your team members or your peers, and they wonder about, you know, oh, wow, if this person is this upset about this, or is, you know, concerned about this, then maybe I should be worried too. And so that's one of the big things to watch out for, I think, as you progress in your career, if you are a passionate person, is to use caution in how you exhibit that in groups of people, especially groups of people that you're a leader for.
I think that's a good point. I mean, we often call it leaders speaking through a megaphone. You know, it's like, oh, you can say something very quietly and it's, you know, lands on people. Well, Lori said, you know, and I have to keep saying, this is just feedback. You take it under advisement, make your own decision, but here's what I think. You know, so I think that that's a really good point.
I tend to agree with you. I think maybe men just express it in a different way than we do, but they're just as passionate about things. And for me, I kind of call it a stop, breathe, smile, or laugh moment. And I get to a point where when I do feel I'm starting to be emotional about something, and my staff will say to me sometimes, I'm surprised you can laugh or smile about this. I would just be furious. And it's a situation where I just kind of have to breathe, have to slow down. And then there's going to be some times when you're in those situations where maybe it's a situation where you take a break and leave the room if it begins to be, you know, just a little bit too harsh if you're in those kind of situations. And I agree, it's probably not for the workplace, but if that does happen and you wind up in those kind of situations, it may be a situation where you just need to stop and maybe leave the room or leave the situation, but at least take some time and learn how to have a breathe, a smile, or a laugh moment during that for yourself personally. And that'll keep you from getting emotional or more emotional.
Absolutely. Okay, another question?
Hello?
Yes.
Hi, my name's Odette Embriaco. I'm a DBA for Huntington Ingalls. How do you handle pushbacks?
So pushback in general or?
Yeah, just in general.
From your team?
You want to move your team forward and you keep getting pushback. How do you handle those situations?
Well, I think usually, I don't know if you were going to jump in, but I think the first thing to do is make sure you understand the other person's position. You know, it's like, do I really understand what they're trying to say? And can I say it and they agree? Yes, that's my point. That's the first step, you know, to anything, because you might just have a misunderstanding and you have more agreement than you think. The other thing that works is to take a step back. At some point, we have shared goals. You know, we work for the same company, so we must have some goal in common somewhere along this, you know, strategy level. So it's like, instead of being all into the issue that you're talking about, it's like, okay, what's the larger problem we're trying to solve? Do we agree on that, you know? And both of those tactics, I think, tend to help me, because you've got to explore and discover to bring people along. There are times where someone just won't be brought along, like they're just not going to come along. And then it becomes a one-on-one conversation that's like, we've been dragging this on, it's interfering with the productivity of the business and the team. I need you to just get on board and agree to disagree, or, you know, you can't be a part of this project, you know, or something like that, you know, if it comes to that. But usually people are reasonable and they just want to understand, you know, are these concerns being taken care of and are they being thought of as part of this plan? And you want to just make sure you're empowering all that brain power towards the problem. You don't want to shut it down just because of the initial disagreement. It might be just the way they're trying to express how to contribute to make a better plan.
I think you have to come to the table ready too. If you know that you're bringing something to the table, whether it's a project or whatever, and there may be some pushback, you have to anticipate. So if there's going to be some pushback, you have to work as a part of a team. And if there is that pushback, say, hey, let me look at that. Entertain all the ideas that are on the table. And then you go back, you can come back to the table later with some better ideas of how things would work to both areas. That would suit the person maybe who's pushing, and that would also work for you. But you definitely want to anticipate. If you're coming to the table with something pretty serious on a project, you should know everybody else who's seated there and what are some of the things that the issues they may have as well. That helps to be prepared.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Yeah, we have another question here.
Yes. Hi, my name is Anusha. First, let me thank you for organizing this session. This has been great. It's just great to be in a room full of women and some men, let down your guard and talk about topics close to your heart. So, you know, there's a thought of being bossy, but on the flip side, I find women being overly self-conscious and being overly apologetic about just about everything that, you know, you just blame yourself for just about everything that's happening in a room. You know, a man drops a cup and you apologize for it. I was just kidding. But I do notice that women tend to be overly apologetic. I want to know if that's something you have noticed. Is that a strength or weakness? Does it play in our favor or not? What do you think about it?
So my opinion on that one is I think it does tend to be a little bit more of a characteristic of women. I think it's actually kind of a strength for us, though. Given the situations that we work in with huge numbers of people, being open to admitting fault is actually something that is not necessarily super pervasive in our culture. And I'll speak for myself, in our culture, on our team and Xbox at Microsoft. And so, going to be specific. So I think that this actually is a very welcome sort of approach to things and situations, and I've seen it more often than not actually open other people up to saying, oh, well, you know, someone dropping a cup, okay, not necessarily that example, but other situations where someone has gone, you know what, gosh, I'm really sorry. If I had done this differently or better, this might have turned out better. And then someone else in the room will go, oh, but it's not really your fault because I did this piece of it. And it was kind of both of us. And it just changes the tone of the discussion in a lot of cases. And so I actually think it's a great trait across the board. I have seen it. It tends to be a little more something that I see women do more often than men. But that's definitely not a consistent across all men, of course, or all women. But I think it's a good thing.
Yeah, the arbitrary apologizing, I agree, is a problem. When you're apologizing and you're not even sure what you're apologizing, it's sort of apologizing for being there. And I think that's a problem. When you have and that's an inner confidence thing, that you have to know that you have the right to be in that room. But an apology is a tremendously powerful thing. I don't know if you know the Blue Angels, the Navy pilots that do the stunt flying. After every single exercise that they do, they get in a ready room together and they sit around the table and they apologize. They apologize for every mistake that they made. And each person's like, I'm really sorry, I didn't, you know, because millimeters matter when you're doing that kind of work. And I thought that was really striking, that they actually apologize. And it is more striking for men than for women because we do it a little bit more easily. But if you think of an apology as something that you stop sort of dropping automatically as a sign of a lack of self-confidence, and you start leveraging as part of your portfolio in the way that Kim described, it's an enormously powerful thing. Have either of you seen that work in the workplace?
One of my big things, I think, in looking at this is you can make those apologies. Things are going to go wrong. You're going to make mistakes. But then you have to move on. I think that's the important part, is how you move on. You make that apology. You move on to the next thing. And then when you take that next step, it needs to be bigger and better. As simple as that. You've got to let it go. You can't beat yourself up constantly. And that's something I've had to learn myself personally. Things are not going to be perfect. When I make those mistakes, I move on. And then I'm always setting a goal for the next project or the next thing I'm working on. It's going to be 10 times better.
And that way it's not a confidence underminer. It's part of your strength. It's part of getting to the place that you want to be. Our next question.
My name is Deirdre Pendleton, and I'm a software developer, and I wanted to ask your experiences with communication with your coworkers, and specifically like speech patterns and thought process, because I've noticed sometimes when talking, I have a tendency to be very descriptive and I can multitask, and so when talking to my coworkers, sometimes they'll kind of look at me like I've sprouted wings and I'm balking like a chicken. So I was just wondering if you guys had techniques in regards to that, or advice, or anything else that you might have.
I'll be happy to take that on and say, be yourself. You are going to come across the best when, first of all, you have to enjoy your jobs. I don't think we've touched on that enough. For you to go in, you're going to spend so much time in your workplace, whether it's physical or mental. I heard the comment about the cell phones. I'm on call pretty much 24/7. So even though maybe I'm not on my job and at my workplace, basically I'm still there. A part of me is always there. So you're going to spend so much time at your job, whether it's physical or mental. So you have to be yourself in what it is that you do. I'll never, and I guess I'm a talker too and descriptive, so I'm guilty. I'll never forget, as a part of an interview team, I had a person on the team, because I was very, very descriptive, to say to me, I'm going to give you a question and I want you to answer it in 60 seconds. As simple as that. So you may want to practice on that. That was one of the things I had to do. And that being said, I'm going to shut up.
It's funny because I actually had career coaching on that specific point fairly early on in my career, that I never, when asked a question, I always told a story before I answered the question. It's extraordinarily powerful if you train yourself to just say yes or no and then tell the story you were going to tell anyway. And I remember the first time my boss asked me a question and he said, can you do X and Y at the event that's coming up? And I said, yes. And where was the arguing? Where was the discussion? Where was the commentary? So it's not, you want to be yourself. It is not a weakness to have that sort of level of feedback and that level of commentary. But it does seem to make things easier for people if you just say yes or no up front. And then, as I say, go into whatever it was you were planning to say anyway. It doesn't take long to get the hang of it.
The
other thing that I would add on that one is know your audience and who you're talking to and what they actually care the most about, because you probably are the SME on whatever you're talking about. And if you understand what they really care about, you can focus on those areas and give a great amount of detail that'll be very helpful to them and to your conversation. So I think that's one of the big things too for me as I tend to be talking to as well.
That's what I would have said. I mean, we took this class called Insights Training, and I don't know if any of you have taken it, where there's four colors, red, yellow, blue, and green, and how people, you know, red people is kind of like be bright, be brief, be gone, you know, so a long story for that person. The yes up front would be very important, but a blue person's more into all the data, and so they might just really want all the information. So if you kind of, that framework has helped me a little bit when talking to people on my team, is you're like, hey, that person kind of responds a little better. I can think of them that in that framework, that color, oh, I need to inspire this person. They're very yellow. They're going to be excited if we talk about the problem in that way. That's been really helpful for me. It's called Insights Training. For those of you who haven't gone, I highly recommend it. It's very insightful.
It's a good point, too, on knowing your audience, because I work with that manager now, and I know if I'm going in his office to talk to him about anything, it needs to be quick, precise, and to the point.
Yes.
So.
Do we have another question at the back?
Back here. I have a couple. Oh, there's a delay. I have a couple of questions, actually. As an engineer, I've been in a lot of engineering teams where I'm the only woman in the room, and there is very much a culture of whoever shouts the loudest is the one that gets heard and gets their way. My technique in the past with dealing with this has been to ask, look, we need to have rules of order in the meeting so that everyone can be recognized, everyone can be heard. But a lot of times people just refuse to abide by it, and it remains this culture of whoever shouts the loudest gets heard. And I find that personally kind of exhausting and kind of frustrating. I don't want to have to get all emotional and raise my voice and shout to make my point. And I don't know if any of you have ever dealt with this, or if anyone in the room has dealt with this, and if so, how have you dealt with it? That's my first question, and I know I probably shouldn't ask a two-part question, but also, have you ever been in a situation where someone has done a whisper campaign that has damaged your career? And if so, how do you recover from it?
Let's take those two separately. I know from the nodding that people have strong opinions about the shouting in the room, so I will let my panelists go. Is there someone who wants to start?
I think what you're talking about is you're trying to make a culture change across your team. And a culture change isn't just agreeing to a set of ground rules on a board. That's just not going to stick. I think it's... what I would do in trying, if I'm not the manager of the team, it doesn't sound like you're the manager. If you're the manager, you have a little bit more authority and a lot more options in how to change the culture. But I would just try to enroll people in the one-on-one in terms of the opportunity for a culture change. You know, it's like, hey, if we didn't have to scream like this, how do you feel? You know, like, I notice you're not speaking up much either. Do you have ideas in it? And are you frustrated? And, oh, so it's not just me who feels this way. Well, how can we change that? You get more people to kind of play by those rules, you know, and to give more space, or just you have someone in the room say, hey, Mary, what do you think? You know, and you can say, so at least you're kind of a little bit changing it a little bit. I'd also think about going and asking the manager about it too, what they think about having a different culture on their team that is a little bit, you know, calmer and more inclusive of a variety of opinions and ways of expressing them. I wouldn't want to escalate that. I think it's more of a, you just want to, the way you can inflict a culture change or enhance a culture change is by one by one on people, and then you have more, and then it just happens. But it's a slow process and very, very hard to do. So I feel for you greatly.
Please do not think ever that there are not other people in this room who have not experienced the same thing.
Yes,
it's a common problem.
Definitely experienced it.
Yeah.
You can also vocally lower the tone if you have somebody who is just screaming, or you have a group at that very, very high, loud level. You can also bring the tone down yourself, mm-hmm. just with your response, keeping it slow and low. You'd be surprised at, you know, sometimes people don't realize what they're doing. Sometimes it's intentional, mm-hmm. but when they really don't realize it, you can actually bring the tone down yourself as well.
Yeah, I think you hit the nail on the head with the cultural shift, and it's a hard problem. Teams that have sort of operated that way, and people who were actually rewarded either directly or indirectly for those types of behaviors, that is a hard thing to overcome, and it's definitely something I have seen in multiple teams. It's something that just needs to have attention from everyone at kind of every level to change it. And it can be, you know, sort of more organic things in the room, like you talked about, and more of a cultural drive or a shift from the leadership side as well. But it's a tough problem.
And her question about whispering campaigns, where there's a subtle sort of the subtle undercurrent where you're being undercut, we work at Microsoft. I have to say that's not usually the approach.
Yeah, there's not a lot of subtlety.
No,
not a lot of you have any subtlety?
I was gonna say, and our system is first of all, it's not acceptable, but it does happen, and it's just a matter. It's tough, and when it happens, it I think it hits you kind of personally. And you have to take the personal side out of it and always serve professional, go through the correct channels, whether it's through human resources or wherever, where you have to handle that. But usually in our system, people know that's not acceptable. When it does happen, then you do need to handle it and handle it in the right way, the right professional way. There's guidelines, I think, in every organization and agency in order to handle those kind of issues.
And ultimately, you have to let your work speak for itself. I mean, if you continue to just do the work, there is a limit to what can be said.
Exactly. I would add that just to make sure you're not isolating yourself from the rest of the team, because you need to be a part of the team, and you need to have relationships with people on the team. And I think that sometimes I know, especially early in my career, you know, or even now, it's like, I'm here, I get my stuff done, then I go, you know, and I might not take the time to build relationships with other people that I'm working with. And so I'm the last person who has time to go to lunch with the person I worked with a while ago or something like that. But it's imperative that I have strong relationships with the people that I'm working with. And that helps when you're trying to influence a group or drive a culture change or you know, a decision. And it also helps in things like the whisper campaign, because you got people that have your back, and it'll stop with them if that's the best way to do it.
Yeah. Next question.
Hello.
Yes.
Hi. My name is Christian Flickinger. And obviously I'm a guy. I'll ask the first question from the guys here. Do you guys have any specific advice for the men in the room on how we can better help move forward and progress this topic within our organizations?
Thank you for trying. The biggest thing is like awareness and effort there. One of the things that, and I'll share with you one of the personal things from the team that I work on right now that is a challenge, is that awareness is like the whole problem. I have almost never seen men deliberately do anything against women, generally speaking, in an organization. It's all completely inadvertent. And a lot of it has to do with actually relationships. And we had this sort of good old boy kind of thing going on. The Xbox team is just almost all men. and historically has been almost all men. And some of that has changed over the last few years as Connect came out and we started to build entertainment experiences that were more focused on families rather than just 18 to 28-year-old men, or 12 to 28-year-old men. And so one of the things that we saw in the organization as more and more women came in was there was sort of this, they were excluded from things because the guys would go out after work and drink and hang out. Well, that built relationships between the guys and the girls were sort of not included in that, but not deliberately. And so it was one of those things where just the awareness piece of it was critically important to starting to change some of those cultural norms within the team. And so that's the biggest thing that I would say is be inclusive and be aware.
And I think when some of the lunch meetings and when the guys go out at lunch, it's not a hard thing to just go in and ask, say, hey, are you guys really going over to Dave & Buster's for lunch? Can I join the group? I did that when I first came in. I want a pretty male team, but they're very, very inclusive to include me when they're going out for lunch, if they're doing dinner with wives and things like that. So it doesn't hurt, I mean, to ask, hey, you guys, oh, really, you're doing that? Can I come along? I promise you, it's not too often they're going to say no.
Yeah, and it's a social thing as much as anything else. It's the being inclusive even in your topics of chat. So, for example, I work on a team with men who are completely obsessed with building motorcycles and taking them apart again. And I don't really get that, because I would think that once you had finished putting it together, you would, you know, leave it alone for a while. But no, we're just going to take it apart again. And it's been interesting to me sort of watching the dynamic of how we can make what are the shared topics of conversation? How can we get them to, it's not that they're trying to be exclusive, they just really love the motorcycles a lot. but that's the kind of thing that you sort of suddenly notice is that there's this little group off in the corner that isn't necessarily participating, and how can we come up with conversational topics that everyone can enjoy, like Game of Thrones? Which is, again, a slightly more... A slightly difficult topic for the workplace I give you.
Say.
I know. It's a tough one. That had its pitfalls. But you see what I mean. I mean, even in this room, we're trying to think of neutral examples of topics of conversation, and it's not easy. So that's the kind of inclusiveness that you want to think about. And really the points I think that our panelists have been making around, it's not just about the work, and it's not just about the conference room. It's about the lunch, and it's about the drinks, and it's about the hallway, and it's about generally making a place where you have relationships with individual people, not men and women in groups, not having relationships with each other. So, can we have our next question?
My name is Tiffany Wallace, and I would say that insights is something I strongly believe in. So Myers-Briggs is the philosophy behind it. And from a team perspective, if your organization hasn't done something like that, it's a huge win for a team. To identify who you're working with and how you go into a meeting, you might go in that you're meeting with someone who's super analytical and you bring all this data, it makes such a big difference to them. If that's not your style, basically, you'll win them over. And what I was going to ask is that I think I typically, or in my organization, the men that I'm peers with, it's a wonderful partnership, right? I mean, there's definitely a lot of camaraderie and we work together on projects, but I see often that from a leadership perspective, that a woman that is not in an executive position who brings information, it's almost like it's not respected the same way. And this isn't, I hear this question often, so that's why I bring it up, that they aren't respected the same way or it's not taken as seriously than when a man brings it up. And so I'm wondering if you see that or you've been, that's come up in the workplace for you as well. That they're not taken as seriously.
Yeah, I feel like when I was really junior, you know, I felt I had to prove myself technically, and I do feel like people were ready to kind of say, you know, you don't know that, but, you know, I had to provide a heck of a lot more data, I felt, for my technical decisions to stand. But that went away really early in my career. I feel like it was kind of the people that had all just come out of college or, you know, that peer group that I was working with, that I think they're all just trying to find their footing, you know, in the workplace, and they don't really know what the boundaries are or, you know, what to expect of people, and it might have just been that. But I feel like since then I haven't noticed any difference. We have a vice president of development. She runs the development or, you know, discipline in Visual Studio. So, and what she says is equally admired and respected to her peer group. So I just haven't noticed that since my very early days in my career.
I haven't either with my group, and our application development person comes to the table with a lot of stuff, and she's a female, and the same thing in with me, with the marketing, the business administration. I handle all the financials as well, and I don't see that, but I think it comes as a part of a culture change. I think we talked about that here, and I think the fact that you guys are here for this event, I mean, you're learning. There's so much information that you can take and you take back. I think that's all a part of it. If you continue to learn more in your career, I remember going into meetings when I first joined the group I'm in right now, and everything was about acronyms. And acronyms can mean many, many different things, and people tend to do that to you. I don't think this group did it deliberately, but you know, they were popping with the knowledge and information. So I sat down, I did my homework, I went back, I looked up things. I mean, these are the type of things that you have to do. It's a part of a culture change, and as a part of your job, if you're researching and you're working and you're constantly learning on what's going on with technology, you just have to stay on top of what's happening, whether you're male or female.
When you were coming into Xbox, did you feel like that was a transitional point where you maybe weren't as taken as seriously, or were there?
Sure, yeah. I mean, I was the new person. I had no entertainment and gaming experience in my background, so I definitely had to prove myself. I had an opportunity. We were shipping Xbox One. We were starting to build Xbox One when I came into the team, and so that was a pivot point for the whole entire organization. That was a good time to come in to be able to prove myself in that situation. But absolutely, it was not unfounded, though. So I think I was in a situation where I had to prove myself, and that was actually legitimate. So I also haven't had a experience where, when I've been in a leadership position and I've been an expert in that area, that my opinion was seen as it wasn't respected in any way, or I haven't seen that happen with other women either compared to men, their men peers. So hasn't been a problem that I've really witnessed.
I would say that there's a way to be a little more strategic about meetings and those sorts of opportunities to express your opinion or present a set of data that I learned at one point in my career, which is run it by someone who's going to be in the meeting and first and get their opinion. And you'll get a lot from that. You'll get potential hot buttons, you'll get holes in your theory, and you'll get an ally in the room who knows what you're trying to say and can say it in different words, and you can just step back and let that person say it, and your argument becomes so much more powerful when it's more than one person making it in the room.
Yeah, and I will say I have had that happen to me. I was in a room with one of our vice presidents some time ago, and he kept looking at the man next to me even when I was speaking. And which was unnerving, and he would address his responses to what I had just said to the man next to me.
Wow.
And I had never had this happen. I had never had this happen to me in my entire career. And what I noticed was if I stuck with it, it took, I had to keep trying. He would not address his responses to me. The guy would kind of shrug, like, well, I didn't say it to begin with. And so I pretended that he was speaking to me. I pretended that he was taking me seriously, and I continued on my way. And I will say that it took like 30 minutes, but by the end of the meeting, he was actually speaking directly to me. So I think that there's a persistence factor to it. And that if there is a room where you feel like you're not being taken seriously, you can't get frustrated. I like the low and slow. I like that idea.
Yep.
You have to just stick with it, and you have to stick to your guns in the calmest way humanly possible. Because you're only going to make it worse if you try to draw attention to yourself in an inappropriate way. So I do hope it never happens to me again, but I will validate the experience of that. Good Lord, I still, to this day, I haven't figured that one out, of the logic of ignoring a person who's speaking. So do we have another question? Yes.
Hello? Okay. Hi, my name is Chigozie Jabber. I'm with the Annie E. Casey Foundation. I'm a senior network administrator. And the question I have is, how do we, women in technology specifically, how do we balance our roles in the home with the kind of field we are? So you have your male counterparts, and it's just the reality. We have to do different tasks in the house than men have to do. And some of our jobs could be on call in 24 hours or whatnot. But, and talk about maybe maternity leave. How do you balance that without feeling a little less than your male counterpart, if that's a good word, or feel like you need to catch up just because of the roles we have?
I guess I can start. I have twin boys, so I was obviously pregnant with twins, and a lot of chaos coming into my life all at once. And I took my full maternity leave, and at Microsoft, we also have a sabbatical, and I tacked that on the end, and I spent and a bunch of vacation, and I spent 8 months at home with my twin boys, just trying to get a little bit of sleep, and just took that time because I felt like, you know, it's a benefit of the company, and I had waited long enough to have kids, and this, I was going to make sure that I embraced this moment as much as I could, you know. So that was a personal decision that I made, and then when I was going back to work, it helped me so much to just know that this is my priority number one, and I need to be there, and I need to be there at home at a certain time, and there's a little bit of flexibility because my husband can run around and do that too, you know, cover a little bit, but I actually want to be there, so it kind of helped me set some boundaries in my life that I could feel not bad about, you know, not like I think, gosh, am I going to be laying on my deathbed going, darn, you know, I really should have spent those extra couple hours at work, or am I going to say, feel bad that I didn't spend enough time with my kids? You know, I think I'm going to care about my family in the global sense more. So how do I prioritize that on a day-to-day basis? And I just think I had to just recognize that I had boundaries and that's what they were, and hey, I'm on my phone, this company gets so much out of me, I go online when my kids are asleep for a little bit, I'm up early, you know, that's not the problem, it's just I shouldn't feel bad for having to leave work, you know, like it's just I'm going to be working more, I'm getting plenty of things done. So it helped me have a sense of self-confidence about I know what my priorities are, and I feel fine doing that because I know I'm doing a good job at work.
And you want to work in environments that respect that as well. I will say this. My first job out of college, I'll never forget, I worked at a nonprofit, and I had a female boss, and I didn't have any pictures of my kids in my office. I kind of felt like, oh, my goodness, if they realize I have three children under eight, they probably, I make it through my probationary period. You see where I'm going? And I know a lot of women tend to hide that. One day I slipped and I said something about one of my kids. And I mean, I've been working there for months. My boss did not know. And I mean, her office was right next door, that I had children. So she called me in later that day and she said, I just want you to know, you know, I'm a single mother. My husband was a pilot. He was killed in Vietnam. And I want you to know, if your kids are sick, whatever, I want you to be there and be with your kids. I don't want you to ever feel that if there's a need for your children and your family that you can't do that. Those are the type of environments you want to aspire. And I know it can't always happen, but you want to aspire to work for people like that. I take the same attitude with my employees that work with me. I have quite a few of them that have children, and it's the same attitude with them. If your kids are sick, I expect you to be home with your kids. You know, we can get work done. Microsoft provides, we use all Microsoft products, they provide a lot of avenues, right, for you to be able to work at home, collaborate, and get things done. And they're very good about that. I don't tell them they have to do that. They do it themselves. They take that responsibility. So to go on and say, hey, I've got my laptop at home, I'm still going to get this project done. I know it's due, but, you know, my kid is sick. It's simple as that. So you have to take that ownership on yourself as well when those kind of things come up, and you know you have people who are relying on you. So that's, but you want to work in those kind of environments where your bosses really have respect for your family as well.
The other thing that I have found kind of with my teens that I always try to remember is that every family is different, and the way that parents take roles in every family is very different. Some families have grandparents that live with them, an extended family. Some families, my own, my husband is the stay-at-home dad. A lot of my coworkers, their wives stay at home. And so I just try to make sure that I am helping to support a culture where everyone on my team has the option to take whatever role, or their family to take whatever roles that work for them and for their children and for their extended families, and support them in those decisions. It's interesting. I have
run into some things that I didn't expect, being the breadwinner, being the stay-at-home, or the working parent with a stay-at-home husband, that you may not really even realize. On the flip side of it, the women who are stay-at-home spouses, who my husband knows, you know, we show up to school events, and I'm inevitably late, like the dads. And, you know, it's okay for their husbands to be late because they're the working father. But my family, who I have a stay-at-home dad and I'm the working parent, it's not okay for me to be late because I'm the mom. Yes. So it's a really interesting double standard that I've found sort of across the board. And so one of the things for me, it's a personal issue for me just because my family is a little different this way than the norm. But then also from a leadership perspective, I try to really make sure that for my teams, they are supported in however they decide to structure that for their own families.
I think that you'll find that the people who give you the most difficulty about it are the people who aren't necessarily all that happy with their own choices. I live in a neighborhood where the majority of the women stay home, and we have an elementary school that's heavily dependent on volunteers, and there has been a certain amount of criticism about the fact that I can't participate at the level that some of the other moms can participate. And the criticism is never from the moms who are really happy about their own choices. It's always from women who are like, well, I was thinking about going back, but it was too hard, and I couldn't manage it, and I don't understand how you do it. And I'm like, I don't understand how I do it either. None of us understands how we do it. You cut corners, you make it work, you put your kids first, you put your work first, you worry about the house a little bit later. We cut corners. And I think that what you have to look for is to have at least enough supportive people around you who understand that you are doing your darndest not to cut the important corners, that you really want your work to be great, and you really want your family to be great, and maybe you don't care so much about the house being clean, and maybe you're not going to volunteer as much at the school as you would like, and maybe you're not going to make the Halloween costume from scratch, you're just going to go to the store and buy it. There was a thing in my neighborhood all about how you had to bake the birthday cake. I do not bake the birthday cake. It is best for everyone. I mean, but that's the kind of thing I mean, is you have a sense of unity. You're right. Women take on different things often. Nobody expects my husband to bake the birthday cake. It would never come up. So you look at the expectations that are set on you and you evaluate them as though, I mean, are they reasonable? Does it make sense? Does anyone benefit from this slightly arbitrary standard? Or is it my kid who really needs me at the party at school in the middle of the day because it really matters to him to have his mom there? That's a different equation than the birthday cake versus the store birthday cake. So, yeah. Do we have another question?
Good afternoon. My name is Paula Hernandez, and I'm a college student. I have a question for you guys as a director and as a manager. As a female, have you ever felt competitive or superior towards other managers, especially male managers? Thank you.
Do you rock? Because I think you kind of do.
I guess I really take this feeling that I am not, because I'm a manager, I'm not a superset of all the skills of the people that work for me, that I can learn from any person, anywhere, anytime. I have a lot to learn. And so that's kind of my attitude, you know, kind of in terms of managing people and working with others, is they bring different things to the table, and there's something to learn. And I think that's the healthy way to approach things. I'd be dishonest to say I've never been competitive with anybody at work. It wasn't because they were male or female or anything like that. I think it was really at the points in time of my career where I'm doubting myself that I can look and say, well, I'm better than that person, or I'm better than that, you know, and that's not a healthy place to be. I would not recommend going there, but that's just a little bit of my vulnerability and my struggle personally, is just to, when I lose my confidence, that might be a place where I go, and I have to remind myself, okay, let's remember, recount the good things that you've done. I'm the type of person who, you know, writes my performance review, and what did I do? I don't think I did anything. And then it's like, oh, but I messed that up. You know, like I can remember all that. So sometimes I just need to have to take it as a sign to rebuild my self-confidence, because that's the genuine leader and person that people want to work with and work for. You don't really want to work with someone who's trying to take someone else down, especially if you're working at the same company. You know, like, we're trying to be successful and bring the stock price up here together.
Something I've always found interesting at Microsoft in particular is that we're kind of a big group of sort of type A overachievers. We hire from like the best schools, we hire the best people from the industry, and when I look at it, we're just naturally very competitive because that's the kind of people that we brought into the organization. So I think that it's something that you, as I've advanced in my career, that I've kind of realized is that there's this healthy kind of competition, and then there's a very fine line of where it gets too unhealthy. And sometimes that is a difficult line to sort of straddle over time for a team. But I think it was you that mentioned it earlier, but kind of focusing on people's individual strengths and the diversity of your team and that you're not a superset of your team is a super important piece of that, because it's really about where you're going to find yourself in being your biggest success is really about where your natural skills offer the most unique value to a given team. And so it's really about time and place where you can be ultimately the most successful. And so if you look at that from your own perspective and then for the perspective of your teams, if you're a lead or a manager, I think it's a really healthy way to try to deal with some of that competitive aspect of it.
Vanessa?
The way we're structured at the university, because we have in our IT area, we have everything from telecommunications to the learning labs, distance learning, infrastructure, you name it, customer support. There is no competition. Everybody has their strong areas and has their strong teams, so we all try to work together. But what I will say, just in mentoring other college students, whether I've had them as interns or they've worked with, in my particular area, one of the big things I try to tell them is if you see something, it's not a matter of being competitive with coworkers or fellow classmates or whatever. If you see some type of trait that you think is amazing, look at that and intend to adopt that. Look at that in your long-term future and say, hey, I think I'd like to get to that point. Put that on your little checkoff list, but try to stay away from being competitive with your office mates. I mean, it's not healthy in the long run.
Yeah, so I think we're at time and I want to wrap us up. Thank you so much for your participation. I hope that we've provided at least some useful information. I want to thank our panelists so much for being here today and for sharing their experiences.